Tichah for Parshas A is in Chelek Beis, Volume 2 of Likutei Sichos. In today's Seder, the Torah tells us about the animals that we may eat, Asher Techelu, the animals that are pure, and those animals that are not pure and that we are not allowed to eat, Asher Lei Techelu, and it gives us the signs to know which is kosher and which is not. It tells us that the kosher animal which we're allowed to eat is ma'alas geza, it chews its cud, and masreses parsa, it has a split hoof. Now there are two kinds of signs that the Torah gives. One is the sign that makes the thing what it is. What is it that makes the kosher animal kosher? It is the fact that it has split hooves and the fact that it chews its cud. Another way of understanding a sign is that the animal is kosher because of some mystical unknown reason. But how do we identify? How do we recognize? How do we spot the kosher animal? We are given the clue that the animal that is kosher will have the signs of chewing its cud and having split hooves. But that's not what makes the animal kosher, that's merely what identifies the kosher animal as kosher. But either way, even if the signs are only an identifying sign, but not a causative sign, it's not what makes the animal kosher, even if it's only a sign, the fact that this is the sign for this particular subject, that these two things, the chewing of the cud and the split hooves, is what identifies a kosher animal, then the signs must in some way be related to the kashrut, to the purity of the animal itself. So the lesson that we can derive from the signs that the kosher animal has, which makes it asher techelu, which you can eat. So in order to understand the lesson and the message, we first have to understand what does it mean to eat. In the world there exists the inorganic, like salt and water, that can be eaten, and then there is the vegetable, then there is the animal, and then there is the human. When a human being eats meat or a vegetable or an inorganic food, he raises the food to the level of the human by absorbing it into his system, and it becomes flesh and blood of a human being. Then thereby the food, whether it's a vegetable or an animal, becomes part of the human. It is elevated to the level of the human. In the human being itself, there are also these four categories. There is that part of the human being which is human. There is the part of the human being which is animal. There is the part of the human being which is vegetable. And there is the part of the human being that is inorganic. And that's what the Gemara means when it says that in three ways, in three areas, the human being is similar to the animal. But then there's the fourth part of the human being, which is the human within the human. Now, just as the literal vegetable, animal, and inorganic product, it does not exist for itself, but finds its elevation, comes to its completion by being absorbed into the human being. And by eating meat, you're actually elevating the vegetables that fed the meat. And the inorganic world, the earth and the water and the minerals that went into creating the vegetable, so that by eating the meat, you're actually elevating and absorbing the inorganic, the vegetable, as well as the animal. So just as in the world in general, the highest level is the human being, and the goal is to absorb all the other levels into the human being and raise it to the level of the human being, the same is true also of the four parts within the human himself, that the part of the human being that is animal, the part of the human being that is vegetable and the part of the human being that is inorganic, they do not exist for themselves. They are not an end in themselves, but rather they have to be absorbed into the human part of the human and raised to that level. And so, by extension, when a human being eats meat, he has to raise that meat not only to the level of the human in general, but to the level of the human within the human. So it's not enough that the animal feeds and is absorbed into the animal part of the human being, but it has to be absorbed into the human part of the human being, into those activities and into those experiences that make the human human. What is the function of the human? So we're told that a person is called Adam because it's related to the word Adame, similar, a reflection of that which is above. So a Jew, an Adam, is not meant to be an end in itself, but that the Adam is meant to be absorbed in that which is above, in godliness, by being similar, by carrying out the instructions, by being a messenger of God, then we become similar, we become godly. So that is the elevation of the human being, to be elevated to the source of the human being, to the source of life, which is godliness. And this happens step by step until a person becomes so united, so completely merged with godliness, that he fulfills the instruction of Uvei Sidbakun, to cleave to God. And as we find with Moshe Rabbeinu, where Moshe, the level of Moshe was that he was able to say, V'nasati Esev, I will produce the grass. If you follow my commandments, I will make the grass grow. He said, I will make it grow. Of course, he was speaking for God without having to say, without having to quote God. He could say, I, and it meant God, because God spoke through Moshe. So it was God speaking, even though it was coming through Moshe's throat. And that is the level of complete and total devotion and cleaving to God, that God can speak through him without having to be quoted. And so as the person becomes Adam Le'elyon, as he gets more and more connected to godliness, he raises with himself, he brings up to that level even the inorganic vegetable and animal that he had absorbed and that had become part of him. Now the question is, how can a human being transform that which is animal or that which is vegetable and cause it to rise to godliness, when by its very nature, the nature of the animal, the nature of the vegetable and the inorganic is to move away from godliness? So how do we change the very nature of these products? First, by absorbing. How are we able to absorb the products into the human level, into becoming part of what we are? And then how do we raise that up further to be merged and to be joined into the godliness that we are connected to, that we become merged and joined with? So in order to be able to do all of this, the Torah tells us that there are two signs that show us whether we're going about it correctly and we're actually affecting an elevation in the food that we eat or not. So the first thing is, if a person is using the physical ingredients, the substances of the inorganic, the vegetable and the animal, whether he's doing it for a heavenly reason and part of the service of God, only then he is able to elevate the food, that they should also become part of godliness, And then the Torah says, "Asher techelu," then you may eat it. Or it's also possible that he's not doing it the way it should be done. He's not eating it as part of his service of God, but rather he eats only because his nature dictates and his habit dictates that he must eat. Then you're not elevating the food. You're not producing an elevation in the food. On the contrary, instead of being elevated by the human, the food actually drags the human down to a lower level. And then the Torah says, "Asher lo techelu," then you should not eat it at all because you're not elevating it. How do we know that a person is doing whatever it is that he's doing for a heavenly purpose, as part of his service of God, or whether he's doing it only by nature and by habit? So the Torah tells us, Chassidus tells us, that a person by nature cannot be two opposites at the same time. He can't be kind and severe to the same degree at the same time. So if his nature is kindness, then he can't also do something severe with the same enthusiasm as he does kindness. Or if a person is strict and severe, that's his nature, then he can't also do acts of kindness with the same enthusiasm as his severity. And that's why it says by Avraham Avinu that when he was given the tenth of his ten tests, and that was to bring his son, to bring Yitzchak up to the Akedah as a sacrifice, only when he was ready to do that, God says, "Now I know that you are God-fearing. Now I know not only about the Akedah, about the sacrificing or the binding of Yitzchak, but now it has been revealed that the other nine tests are also out of a fear of God and not merely out of nature." Because the first nine tests were all expressions of God, of Avraham's love. It was all in the category of kindness. And Avraham was the essence of kindness. So the question was, the doubt was, did Avraham pass the nine tests of kindness because he was by nature a very kind person? Or was he kind because that's what God called for and it was part of his service of God? When did we know, when was it obvious and clear that he did his kindness because of God and not because of his nature? When he was ready to do an act of severity, of sacrificing, binding Yitzchak, with the same devotion as he did the kindness. Because if it were by nature, they couldn't both exist in the same person to the same degree. And that is the sign of kashrus, that is the split hoof. When you have only one category, when you belong to only one category because that is your nature, then you have a single hoof. When you have a split hoof, it means that you're going in two directions at the same time, that you can go either way with the same or with equal amount of enthusiasm. And that can only be if you are motivated by a higher consideration, something beyond your nature. So that it's possible for a person to transcend whatever his nature dictates if he brings into the equation God's interest, if he brings into the equation his neshama. Since the neshama is neutral on all of these subjects, on all the physical activity, to the neshama it really doesn't make much of a difference one way or the other. So what determines for the neshama which way it should involve itself in the physical world, whatever God says, whichever way God prefers, that's fine and perfectly comfortable for the neshama. Because for the neshama, again, it can go either way. So when a person is equally enthusiastic about mitzvahs that are kind and mitzvahs that are severe, if all mitzvahs are treated equally, that shows that his behavior is dictated not by his nature, but by his neshama. And so that is the sign that the person is going about his physical activities in a kosher way, and therefore he may indulge in these activities. Asher techelu, this he is allowed to eat, he is allowed to absorb this worldly substance, because he has a split hoof, he is ready to go in any direction that God asks him to go. And so, like a good messenger, he is ready to carry out whatever the message may be, whatever the mission may be. Now, in the laws of this, in the description of the split hoof, there are animals that have a partially split hoof. In other words, the top of the hoof is split, but from the bottom, when you look at the bottom of the hoof, it's all one piece. So there's a cleft in the hoof, but it is not literally, truly two independent halves of the hoof. In order for the animal to be kosher, it has to be split all the way through. They have to be two distinct halves to the hoof. And that means that it's not enough that a person can on the surface go both ways. That on the surface, he can be strict when he has to be, and he can be kind when he has to be, but that is not enough. The kindness and the strictness has to go all the way through, inwardly, deep down in his heart, he has to be able to go both ways. And only then is it a sign of kosher, only then is it a sign that what he's going to eat will be truly elevated to the level of godliness to which the person is cleaving. And even after all of this, we're still not sure that everything is kosher. Since, in fact, he is involved in physical, worldly things, in the eating of flesh, in the eating of meat, then even if he sees that in himself that he can go either way, he can serve God in whatever way is necessary, which shows that he's not doing it out of the instinct, out of the habit, or out of nature, but that he's doing it for a heavenly purpose, he still needs to have the second sign, and that is the chewing of the cud. Chewing of the cud means re-chewing, rehashing, again and again, rethinking over and over whether what he is doing is right. So that would mean that he has to check again and again, and reconsider, and examine over and over again whether what he's doing is really kosher or not. So all activity that involves a Jew with physical in enjoyment, with physical pursuits, have to constantly be examined on a regular basis to see whether he is still elevating the food or whether the food is dragging him down. So what we learn from this in practical avodah, that when a person goes to eat meat, he has to check to see whether he has both signs of purity, both signs of kashrus. And if not, then he's better off not eating it. And the same is also true with all physical activity. With going to school, going to business, you have to check over and over again to see if everything is kosher. We have to be certain that we are not allowing the dictates of our nature to determine how and where we indulge and we involve ourselves in the physical world, but we have to constantly be guided by our neshama, be guided by our purpose and our shlichus, be guided by the Torah that guides us in a safe and holy fashion through a lifetime of physical involvement where the physical does not drag us down or diminish us, but rather through it we accomplish what we are sent to accomplish, and that is the elevation of the physical world, making even the animal, the vegetable, and the inorganic all a part of the godliness to which we cleave, the godliness to which we aspire, and we raise it all up with us as we raise ourselves. Since this is the month of Elul, the Rebbe adds that in Lakut HaTayza there is an example, a mushal, that tells us the difference between Elul and Tishrei, the month of Elul and the month of Tishrei. In the month of Elul, it's like a king who is in the fields on his way to the city. And in Tishrei, it's like the king who is sitting in his palace. When the king is in his palace, not everyone has the right to approach the king, because there's a whole protocol of how one comes to see the king. There are certain preparations that are necessary and certain conditions that have to be met. But when the king is traveling and he's out in the fields among the people, there the protocol does not apply. There, where he doesn't have all the trappings of the palace and of the royal chambers, because of the absence of those trappings, that makes it possible for everyone to approach the king, and he willingly, gladly, and smilingly greets every person and fulfills their requests. In the month of Elul, God comes to every Jew, wherever the Jew may be, even if it's out in the fields, and every Jew has an opportunity to present his requests and his pleas before God, as he explains there in the Likutei Torah at length. It is also obvious from the above that when the king is out in the fields, one needs to be extremely careful in not making a mistake. Since the person finds himself out in the fields, and in spite of this, the king comes to him and receives his requests, hears his requests, and what's more, he greets him smilingly, this can lead to a mistake. The person can conclude from this that being out in the field, away from the palace, and being in the condition in which he's in is perfectly acceptable, and he doesn't need to change or grow or improve. And the proof of it is that as he is in the condition that he is in, the king comes to him and accepts him approvingly, smilingly, which leads him to conclude that he's doing fine and doesn't need to improve. When the king is in the palace, this mistake isn't possible at all. You can have no mistake, because you know that in order to get to the palace, you have to meet certain conditions. You have to have certain preparations. And only then do they let you into the palace at all. And even once in the palace, there are those who are allowed into the outer chambers, because that's what they're fit for, that's what they deserve. And then there are those who are more deserving, who are allowed into the inner chambers, and so on. So there can be no mistake about the fact that one needs to prepare properly and one needs to be worthy of being received by the king. But when the king comes out into the field and all this protocol is set aside and it is easy for everyone, regardless of their condition, to approach the king, here we have to make sure that we don't draw the wrong conclusion and decide that because the king is friendly, because God is available and friendly, that we don't need to grow and we don't need to improve. And so it is with the month of Elul, that when God comes to every Jew, despite where the Jew may be in his spiritual growth, and God is approving and smiling in his acceptance and his greeting to every Jew, which means that God makes himself available to everyone wherever they may be, here we have to be careful. We shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that because we are in Uvdin Dechil, since Elul is not Yom Tov, the month of Elul is not a Yom Tov time when you're not allowed to work. It's weekdays. Most of it is weekdays where we are involved in the 39 labors that are prohibited on Yom Tov. And even while we're involved in those labors, it is not a Yom Tov, yet God comes and offers himself to us, reveals himself to us, and makes himself close to us. So here we have to know that closeness is a demanding closeness. It demands that we grow from it and grow towards it. It says in the Pri Etz Chaim, in the Kabbalah, that the words La Hashem Vayemru Lemed Ashira, the first letters of those words spell the word Elul, spell out the name Elul. So we need to understand what's the connection between those words and the month of Elul. Those words were said in the Shiras Hayom, the singing after the crossing of the sea, the splitting of the sea. So what is that? What is the connection between those words and Elul? And also, what does it mean, Lemer, that the Jews said, saying? Usually, where you find that expression in Torah, it means that they said and they told others to say. But here, everyone was there and everyone was included in the singing, so who else was there to be told that they should say it as well? So the Rebbe explains that Lema here means for future generations. That the future generations should also sing to God and ki goi go be higher than the high. And this means that when a Jew sings to God, then he is higher than the high. Which means that although there are laws of nature that God instituted, and according to these laws of nature, the world has to behave a certain way, yet when a person sings to God, when a person is serving God with joy, then God puts aside all of these high conditions, the laws of nature and the angels that control the laws of nature, and the Jew is higher than the high. And that is the Aveda of Elul, that we sing, we serve God with joy, devote ourselves to God completely with a tshuva, that this tshuva brings us to singing, to a joy in godliness, and then we become in charge of the world, that the world adjusts to enable us to serve God easier and more readily, and we become goi goa, because we become the balabos over the world, over nature, because Eved Melech, when we serve God as a servant to the king, then the king's servant is in some way himself a king.